I'm Shani Haleem, and I'm with CMS, and I'm the project officer for the contract with Brandeis University that's developed six of the measures that are being reviewed today.
I'm Laura Blum. I'm the director of quality improvement at the Harvard Center.
So before we start evaluating measures and make the best use of everyone's time, Reva and Alexis are going to review the process that we go through in evaluation of the measures and what our role is in the technical advisory panel and the hierarchy of NQF.
Right. When we sent you your meeting materials, we sent you a slide presentation that essentially is our standard presentation to orient all of the various members of this project to what we're doing, what the goals are, and what we hope to accomplish. And I don't want to belabor this, but there are some highlights that I think we need to focus on briefly before we launch into the work of today. So I think most people in this room are familiar with NQF. We have grown. We've got over 400 member organizations spanning the wide range of stakeholders. They are organized into eight councils. That multi-stakeholder representation among NQF is really key to who we are. Certainly there's a divergence of opinions when we get all these folks together, but they all do have a voice at the table, and it's the multi-stakeholder underpinnings that really brings a great deal of strength to the work that NQF does. We'll be talking a lot about the formal process of measure endorsement, which ultimately ends with NQF's board of directors. A subcommittee of the Board of Directors, the Consensus Standards Approval Committee, we will be mentioning. They are an important subcommittee because they essentially do the work of advising the Board on the final recommendations for endorsement. Other contributors to NQF's activities that we have to keep in mind for greater context, and we'll talk briefly about, are the National Priorities Partnership and then the Leadership Network, which are the chairs and vice chairs of each of the member councils. So there's sort of a lot of different ways of people becoming involved in what NQF does. I just point you out to our newest website and recommend that everyone log in, enroll, and get an account number. Anybody in the world can do that. It allows you to customize your searching on our website and find the things, particularly around this project, that might make it easier for you to keep track of what's going on. In order to meet NQF's mission of transparency, the recording of this meeting and all meetings, as well as the transcript of this meeting, will be posted for public view on the website. So I'd like everybody just to be aware of that. You are definitely on the record. All of the project documents, summaries, will also be posted there. So it's a nice resource for you to be able to follow the activities of the project. NQF's mission and strategic goals are things that you can read. One aspect of NQF is we really have grown our portfolio of measures quite considerably. It numbers over 600 now. And certainly one of the major points of discussion is the fact that that probably needs some refinement, better focus on the measures that are likely to be the most useful, the greatest drivers towards quality improvement, and certainly measures that meet important gaps for measurement, particularly things like outcomes. And that's one of the major reasons we're here today. Another issue that's going to be big is data sources and the transitioning to electronic health records as a major priority. As I mentioned, this evolution of the quality measurement, we really want to push, we are looking for measures that raise the bar, that demand higher performance. We do want to look at composite measures as a way of making more robust measures, and we're certainly going to see some of those today, as well as several others in other topic areas in this project. Consideration of measurement of disparities is another important aspect in the ability of measures to help us deal with the concerns around disparities is important. Another major issue is harmonization. A plethora of measures that are all specified slightly differently as to the population or who's included and who's excluded adds confusion to the landscape and does not facilitate implementation. And one of the major goals for NQF endorsement is to facilitate implementation on a widespread basis nationally. So harmonization is another critical aspect and is part of the measure evaluation criteria. As I mentioned, outcome measures, appropriateness measures, cost and research use measures, coupled with quality measures, are some of the major focuses of NQF projects right now, this being the Outcomes Project. I just want to show the NQF bubble diagrams. If you've seen these before, it sort of shows you how NQFs work in this area around developing episodes of care, the episode frameworks. I see these at conferences given by other people all the time, and so they are making their way. They're percolating through the world out there, and we are developing these bubble diagrams around episodes of care around major conditions. The national priorities, I mentioned the National Priorities Partnership is kind of a collaborative effort of 30-some organizations coming together to say what are really the goals of all of these quality improvement enterprises. And they have landed on 6 major goals around patient and family engagement, population health, patient safety, care coordination, end-of-life care, and appropriate slash overuse of care delivery. And so all of the work that NQF does in these projects has in mind the national priorities, trying to find the tools it will take to drive the goals and objectives of the National Priorities Partnership. So we crosswalk our bubbles with our priorities and we end up with messy diagrams like this. However, you can see that the thinking is starting to coordinate and bring together all of these various activities into a cohesive picture, complicated but nonetheless cohesive. This particular project is funded by the Department of Health and Human Services. The focus is on the top 20 Medicare conditions, of which 5 of them fit into this topic area of cardiovascular disease. So that's how you all came to be and how these topics came to be. We did not, from a project management perspective, we did not want to have 20 taps. So we have 8 instead as a way of brought together related topic areas to make it more manageable. There's a wide variation availability of existing outcome measures. Some of our TAPs actually have no current measures that we can identify, and they will be having slightly different tasks. You, on the other hand, are the big winners. Of the 40 measures currently in play for this project, 14 of them are assigned to these 5 topic areas for this TAP and ultimately the steering committee to consider. So this is certainly an area, although within the cardiovascular conditions, we'll find that there are more for a great many of conditions such as AMI and heart failure and relatively few for things like atrial fibrillation and stroke. Our goal for this project is to expand NQF's current portfolio of outcome measures. So this is not NQF's first effort into outcome measures. We've certainly been doing this on an ongoing basis with more outcome measures having become available in most recent years. We certainly have endorsed close to 200 outcome measures across a wide variety of subjects and settings. So, but this one is particularly focused on the top 20 Medicare conditions, though not at all specific to setting of care. We're really trying to look at it from the patient's perspective. So it's not about hospitals, it's not about outpatients, it's about patients with cardiovascular conditions. And wherever they may receive care appropriately, what is the outcome of that care? So this project is phased more for project management than for anything else. Cardiovascular is one of the earliest TAPs that we've already met with the pulmonary group. Metabolic is being split, so we're doing you as one of sort of the big chunk starting out 2010. Well, 2 main project goals. The first one is what your effort is focused on today, and that's to identify, evaluate, and endorse additional measures suitable for public reporting, as well as quality improvement that specifically address outcomes of healthcare. This includes some cross-cutting measures for the steering committee to deal with that are not condition-specific, as well as specific outcome measures for more than 20 common conditions, 5 of which are assigned to this TAP. So this is primarily the work to do today. However, in the course of the discussion and after we've done the work in bullet 1, we will ask you to give us your best thoughts around where gaps of outcome measures are for the 5 conditions in the cardiovascular realm to help inform the industry of where additional measures need to be developed and what would be the most useful way forward to fill the gaps, particularly in some of the topic areas that we don't currently have measures. Developing consensus is NQF's bread and butter. That's what we do. We have a formal consensus development process that is fairly straightforward, but also fairly rigid. It doesn't lend itself to a lot of flexibility in order to maintain that standardized approach to consensus. There is an overall strategy for measuring and reporting healthcare quality that included the goals and priorities from MPP. The multi-stakeholder membership, again, is very important. We do have active participation by consumers, purchasers, health plans, various providers, various professionals, quality researchers. We have community and health, public health members, as well as supplier and industry organizations. So anybody that might think that they've got a stake in this game is a welcome member to NQF. Our board of directors does have both representatives from the public and private sector. We do focus on the entire continuum of healthcare, and once NQF has granted endorsement, the measures are known as voluntary consensus standards. This is the schematic of the process. As I mentioned, it's a fairly rigid process. The role of the technical advisors or panels is noted. Their tasks are advisory to the project steering committee. The role of the TAP is to provide that technical advice to the steering committee. The steering committee's membership does represent the variety of stakeholders in NQF. It is meant to be a proxy for our membership. As such, there are members, again, consumer members, purchaser members, plans, the whole range of members. The steering committee is the decision-making body. However, given the wide variety of topics in this project, and some of them can get quite complicated, detailed, and very focused into some very highly specialized area, the role of the technical advisory panels are to assist the steering committee by looking at the sub-criteria of our standard measure evaluation criteria and provide the preliminary evaluation of those sub-criteria to provide the expert advice to the steering committee. So that is your role in the work we're asking you to do today. The chair, Dr. Gibbons, actually sits as a member of the steering committee, so as well as the chairs of the other seven TAPs, as well as other members. For this particular project, as well as recommending doing the initial evaluation of the measures, suggesting additional measures for those gap areas is certainly an important activity as well. Staff, we do what staff does. I want to mention NQF's endorsement criteria because this is really the fundamental resource for today's work. We have nicely newly printed up and given for each of you a lovely four-page description of the major evaluation criteria. You received one of our earlier just straight PDF documents, not a three. And there are just a couple of minor changes updated to December 2009. The board of directors and CSAC are constantly reviewing the major evaluation criteria, and there have been some very minor tweaks of late. But this will be your major resource, and we really do need that your discussion be focused in on these criteria. And because of that, I just want to briefly hit a couple of the highlights. These evaluation criteria underwent a major overhaul about a year and a half ago. All the criteria are approved by the board of directors. The revisions to the criteria were to strengthen, clarify, and recommend changes to achieve a couple of things. Stronger link to the national priorities and higher level performance measures. You're going to keep hearing this theme. We want to raise the bar, more robust measures. Greater measure harmonization. Harmonization is one of the major evaluation criteria. It's important that if we're evaluating measures that are similar to other measures we've seen or endorsed, that we understand to what degree they are or are not harmonized. Greater emphasis on outcome measures, that's why we're here. And then if we were looking at process measures, tighter outcome process links. And this also applies to intermediate outcome measures. Intermediate outcomes should have a good relationship and a tight relationship to ultimate outcomes. So this is the side-by-side on how the new criteria relate. We've always used four major main criteria: importance, scientific acceptability, feasibility, and usability. couple of significant changes. Importance was often misunderstood by audiences, and so to clarify, this criteria is important to measure and report. Is it worth expending the resources to collect the data, crunch the data, report the data for the information garnered from that? This has several sub-criteria which we'll go into, but this is a must-pass criteria. That decision rests with the steering committee, but just to know that if it's not important to measure and report, it doesn't matter how scientifically good it is or feasible or usable, it just doesn't work. Scientific acceptability is a lot of the nitty-gritty details of the measure properties itself. This is not the science and the evidence behind it. That's under importance. This is, is the measure valid? Is it reliable? Has it been tested? What are the results of that testing? Are the measure, is it precisely specified? Feasibility, again, greater emphasis on health IT. So looking towards transitioning to EHRs and the ability to implement this on a widespread basis. And usability, this is where there's a greater emphasis on harmonization. So I'm just going to hit a couple of things. As I mentioned, the importance to measure and report is the must-pass criteria. I think you all have been looking at these measures. You've looked at the measure evaluation criteria. I just want to hit some high points. There are three sub-criteria under this main criteria of importance to measure and report. Whether it's related to an NQF priority or high impact, in other words, how much bang for our buck are we going to get? What's the evidence behind the measure focus? This is the evidence base for the measure. And what is the opportunity for improvement? So those three sub-criteria are going to be the aspects we're going to ask you to discuss and help and advise the steering committee on the strengths and weaknesses of the measure in that regard. Scientific acceptability, again, has multiple sub-criteria that really is an important aspect of the work you're going to do today to help us provide advice to the steering committee around precision to specifications. What do we know about reliability and validity? What do we know about the data source and comparability? Is this a measure that can address disparities? How is it risk adjusted? Is it appropriately risk adjusted? And what do we know about the methodology for risk adjustment, as well as exclusions? Exclusions have become a big issue for measures. We're hearing from the field that implementation is very much limited if exclusions require a separate data source compared to the main data necessary for the basic numerator and denominator. So looking at these exclusions, being sure that they are appropriate and necessary to the measure is an important part of the evaluation. Usability. Keep in mind that NQF endorses measures for public reporting, so suitability, appropriateness for that use is really what this is all about. And usability has a couple of elements to it, both the public reporting side, but is this a meaningful information for the wide variety of audiences that may be looking for information on the subject area? Usability also, this is for harmonization, so if we're always talking about AMI, are we always talking about the same patients? Having different measures, describing the denominator differently doesn't play very well to the greater audience. Feasibility, the extent to which the required data are readily available, retrievable without undue burden, this is the balance between what do we get for how much it costs. And the feasibility issues are certainly important to many of the stakeholders, and your assessment will be an important part of helping the steering committee. There are other methodologic issues related to outcomes that will be part of your conversations around risk adjustment, rare occurrences, what time window. There may be other issues. Feel free to bring them up. We want to advise the steering committee to the greatest degree possible. So at the end of the day, we're going to ask you to provide a consensus rating on the sub-criteria, but identifying the strengths and weaknesses, your comments, I think will be the strongest part of the advice to the steering committee, and we're going to be capturing it, both notes, recording, transcript, and witnesses. So hopefully we'll be able to tell everybody what we need to. So that's all I want to do right now. Because I think it's time to get to work.
Very good.
I'd ask anybody if you have any questions on the information I just provided.
I have one question. I don't know if this is the appropriate place to bring this up, but I noticed in when you listed the various areas that are being addressed, including in cardiovascular, at least to me, conspicuously absent is hypertension and also dyslipidemia. And I'm just wondering if there's a reason for not looking at hypertension in particular.
Essentially, the things that cropped to the top were the list of 20 that HHS gave us, and hypertension is not.
I thought it was on.
Yeah, I know. I'm trying to remember. Give me a minute. Let me go back.
Hypertension is actually in scope for this project. So
yeah,
if there
it
were
is.
Hypertension measures, it would be fine.
But we haven't identified a lot of outcome measures for that we have not.
Other than the fact that we've already got a fair number of outcome measures regarding blood pressure control, particularly in the ambulatory environment. I don't know if there's anything beyond that you think would be appropriate to consider. Please let us know.
When we did the call for measures, we asked for, you know, cardiovascular topics, including and listed them, but we did not exclude anything. Any other questions? Okay.
So, time to get to work. I think it's important to try to follow the general outline of the measure structure, but to highlight those areas which require comment, so that the initial run-through by the NQF staff has already looked at many of the criteria and scored them, but it's the areas that we have been asked for that are going to give rise to some discussion and perhaps some controversy. So, as we go through, it would be well to try to focus on those areas that you're providing us for. So I think in the beginning, it's useful to just describe what the measure is, what the population is, and really, although it comes at the outset, to describe who the steward is and who the developing organization is. Now, this is because we have the development organization staff available for questions, we are going to not be going in sequence numbered based on the measures, but based on the people who are available to join us this morning or this afternoon. So we're going to be starting initially with the two procedure outcomes, the PCI measure and the ICD measure. So I think it would be well to start with the PCI measure. And I think it's Dr. Ellis.
It is me.
Great.
I'm sorry, can you do it by number? What numbers are those again?
The PCI.
008.
Okay. Please just give me a minute. I was not expecting you at first, but I'm happy to do so.
We're doing well on time, so thank you.
I believe that some other committee members came in during the answer. Would you want to introduce them before?
Sure.
Looking.
Why don't we pick up anybody who came through?
Are there other committee members who've joined us since the introduction?
Hi, my name is Irene Jackson. I'm a neurologist from Cleveland, Ohio.
Very good. Are there any members on the teleconference?
Uh-huh.
Anyone joining us by phone? Not yet.
Okay. What I would propose to do is sort of provide a 30,000-foot view of my critique and then go into the measure evaluation per se.
Great.
That's all right. Provide a very, very brief background for the proposal itself, and that's as follows. Approximately 10 to 15% of the 750,000 patients or so undergoing PCI in the United States annually are readmitted to hospital within 30 days. 60% of these readmissions are associated with a cardiovascular principal diagnosis code, those top codes being heart failure, 12%, other ischemic CAD, 9%, respiratory, 9%, acute myocardial infarction, 6%, and arrhythmia, 5%. And the estimated cost of readmission of this patient cohort is approximately $360 million annually. And there has also been documented substantial hospital-to-hospital variation in this outcome, as I refer you to page 42 in the document. That's the background. The proposal itself is to compare hospital-specific 30-day post-PCI readmission rates as a measure of hospital and transition care quality using the ACC NCDR and the Medicare data databases. For those of you not familiar with ACC NCDR, which I expect there may be a few, this is an ACC PCI registry that was started about 20 years ago. I actually helped in drafting version 1.1 many, many years ago, that captures a number of the patient characteristics, comorbidities, the treatment, and the treatment outcomes, but is limited to in-hospital outcomes. It's fairly extensive at this point in time, and has with it, for instance, an associated risk-adjusted mortality rate with a very high C statistic. It's pretty well developed at this point. It's one of the very early ACC endeavors to register. So the major strengths, is, as I see the proposal, and again, this is looking from a very high level, is it's a relatively common adverse costly outcome with demonstrated intra-hospital variation. I find several other strengths to the proposal. We'll go over into more detail in, to follow. But it's been prepared with input from ACC, SCI, and interventionalist TEP representatives. The statistical methodology overall, I'm not talking about the risk adjustment model, which I'll speak to in a minute, but the overall methodology, which includes the hierarchical generalized linear modeling, is quite sophisticated and appropriate to the topic. The risk adjustment model is modestly predictive of outcome. The calibration is good. The C statistic is 0.66, which one can argue is fair for this general field, but certainly not as good as one might like. And importantly, the authors have proposed that readmissions for staged PCI are excluded. That is to say, on the order of 10% of patients have complex anatomy or renal insufficiency or something that requires a deliberate staging of the procedures, and it would not be fair to hold the second procedure against the hospital or provider. Hence, those are excluded, and that's appropriate. So those are the major strengths. I do find three, I guess I would call them major deficiencies. And the first is the issue of linkage of the providers of the procedure and the transitional care team to some of the outcomes. So patients are readmitted for a variety of reasons, and I listed the top reasons already. But there are a number of reasons that patients are readmitted within this 30-day window that don't seem to have much to do with PCI. So I, as an interventionalist, I have no problem if my procedure doesn't work and the patient comes back with angina, or if I create an AV fissure in the groin that's a mess, or even if I give a drug-eluting stent, which requires Plavix, to a patient that has a peptic ulcer disease and he has a GI bleed, I'm happy to take responsibility for that. I think that's quite reasonable. But there are some outcomes in the readmission groupage that seem to have little relationship to this, and perhaps the most egregious one is chronic bronchitis. So if somebody comes back within 30 days of chronic bronchitis, which represents 1.7% of all admissions, that doesn't seem fair to attribute that to anybody's patient care. Pneumonia is also an example at 2.2%, other diseases of the lung at 1.7%. In aggregate, it appears that about 10% of readmissions have nothing to do with PCI care, and we find that, or I find that to be a problem. Now, the data are a little sparse, but it would appear that if you change the time window from 30 days to 15 days or to 7 days, the proportion of readmissions directly related to PCI increase. And I don't have as much data on this as I would like, but I would give you the example that pneumonia accounts for 2.1% of readmissions within 15 days, but 2.8% between 16 days and 30 days. And I don't have data for others, but I suspect there's that general correlation. That is, the sooner after the procedure, the more likely the readmission is related to that procedure. So that does seem to be a deficiency. On the other hand, it's fairly easy to rectify because of the admission codes. With a couple of caveats. So that's my concern number one. Concern number two is perhaps a controversial issue around this table, but let me try and frame it. We all recognize that we have to do risk adjustment such that we're comparing apples to apples as best we can. For instance, a hospital in Florida whose average age patient is 82 is going to have somewhat different outcomes than my hospital, where my hospital average age is 64. Older people have more comorbidities. They're not all captured. They're certainly more frail. And everybody accepts age as a risk adjustment parameter. What the developers of the model have not done is they have not got a good measure of social support structure, if you will, for identifying resource challenged patients. So patients that have poor family support, difficulties with travel, difficulties affording medications, there's no measure in the risk adjustment model to take care of this. Now, the converse argument is, look, if you risk adjust for this, then you're sanctioning worse care for these patients. But I would argue that's not the case at all. I just gave you the example of age. And we're not suggesting that we provide worse care to the aged. We simply think that this needs to be involved in the risk adjustment model. And in fact, research from my own institution, I'm a senior author on a paper at First Office by Mady Shishibor, appearing in JACC last year, where we looked at patient outcomes comparing patients that had received drug-eluting stents versus bare metal stents in a non-randomized fashion, and looked at a number of measures for risk adjustment. And it turned out a socioeconomic score was among the most important drivers of outcome. And to have that missing from this particular model seems to be a deficiency. And that's my second concern. And the third concern is that only about half, 49%, to be a little more specific, of hospitals doing PCI report to ACC/NCDR. Those are my major concerns. There are some other concerns I'd like to highlight before we go through the major evaluation per se. As any of you that read the proposal realize that the initial model was prepared using only probabilistic matching between the NCDR ACC database and Medicare. It's not an exact match, so it would have to get rectified. The model predictiveness is less than optimal. I mentioned the statistic of 0.66. We can have some discussion around the table. Again, this is a fairly common C-statistic for measures in this area, but it could be improved. There has been to date, and I can be corrected by the end of the table if there's some new data, but I think there's been no demonstration to date that the model repeatedly identifies outlier hospitals. The database model was derived from the 2006 population. There's mention of the 2007 population study ongoing, but I've seen no evidence that that's happened. There also is really not a good demonstration that admission coding in this setting accurately captures the true reason for readmission. There's obviously concern about using administrative databases and coding. It's interesting that the ICD measure that I'm also reviewing actually went to the trouble of doing a careful chart review to make sure that the reasons for the coding for the complications in the ICD population is actually accurately coded. This hasn't been done in this particular field. And lastly, I guess I would list a couple of concerns about perverse incentives. And there are at least two that I can think of here that need to at least be on the table. The first is that one might actually see elongated or lengthened length of stay for the initial PCI presentation if the physicians are going to be graded on outcomes as diverse as presently provided. So it might actually increase length of stay. And secondly, it's actually a disincentive to report to ACC/NCDR. If you're concerned about your outcomes, reporting to ACC/NCDR at the moment is voluntary, so maybe we just shouldn't even report. And that, of course, wouldn't be good. ACC/NCDR, at least at our institution, provides a great benchmark for comparison and quality outcomes. But the hospitals might be incented to give up this reporting if indeed they're concerned about their outcomes. That's my high-level overview, and I think I would stop now. I covered a fair amount of ground, and perhaps we could take comments and questions on those, and then we'll go on to the measure evaluation per se. Is that all right with the chair?
Sure. Comments from the TAP, and we'll have public comments when we finish evaluating the measure, if that's okay. One thing that strikes me is that many of the measures have some of the difficulty. For instance, readmission for heart failure, more than half of readmissions for heart failure within 30 days are not for heart failure. And so the similar controversy arises. Up to 60% of readmissions are for non-heart failure, but more often vascular-related issues, stroke, MIs, and so forth, with pneumonias, bronchitis, bone fractures, right? But so there's the tension between trying to harmonize measures and also trying to approve a measure that is usable and valid.
It wouldn't be that difficult, I wouldn't think, however, because the ICD-9 codes are listed, to simply exclude readmissions for bronchitis.
Right.
But I understand it in terms of the trying to harmonize with the deficiency, but I think that the the scientific validity and the face value of the measure would be enhanced if those readmissions for those folks were excluded.
Right. I think one of the other tensions is trying to reconcile the fact that a procedure is still a hospitalization and a representation of caregiving. And so to narrow it down to the focus of the interventionist taking responsibility for the intervention only may not sit well with third-party payers and people who decide, is this care adequate and optimal?
So I would agree with that, but I think that the focus should be on the patient rather than the intervention per se.
Right.
And we as a group of the interventionists have been criticized in the past for not paying attention to LDL levels and things like that. I think that we, when the patient comes in, it's the opportunity to oversee their overall cardiac care and try and make certain that their transition to the outpatient care is appropriate. So I don't have... I personally, I guess I'm supposed to speak to the ACC, but I personally don't have a problem with that as long as I don't have to take credit for the pneumonia admissions and the like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The final thing, and I want other people to comment, but the final thing that occurs to me is I liked your emphasis on the clinical versus the social limitations of follow-up, and that's something that I think needs to be factored in, or at least considered in emphasizing quality of care. The same thing is true for heart failure admissions, where in my institution, the highest risk of readmission is in the under 65 population than in the over 65 because of the safety net output. So that factoring in, being able to identify social risk as well as clinical risk is going to be very important, and I don't think it's done in the risk adjustment. Yes. Are there comments or issues that the major developer can, Dr. Schubert?
Yeah, I would just say that if a measure is voluntary, the hospitals can opt to report or not. I think that takes the strength out of the measure because we will never know who reports. 2,000 people, hospitals apparently said may opt not to report. This is a major limitation, in my view, if I'm to use this as a measure of quality or cost. If it's voluntary, I think it would have to be for everyone, then it would have some weight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, could I just do a couple of clarifications? I believe that even though the measure was developed using registry data, when CMS would implement this, it would be either using registry data for those that participate in a registry, or they would provide an alternate mechanism for submitting the data. So we'll have the measure steward and developer talk about that in a minute, but just something to keep in mind. The other thing about risk adjustment and socioeconomic status is it is controversial, and our current evaluation criteria suggest not risk adjusting for things that are related to disparities in care. So if those are included, they have to be justified. So
but if I'm speaking from a provider standpoint, I don't want to pick on any ethnic group in particular, but suppose I am I live in a Rust Belt town. I live in Cleveland, although I represent a somewhat unique institution, but we'll talk about more general things. Suppose I have a patient population of somewhat indigent patients who have a very poor social support structure. And I don't really think it's fair to compare my outcomes to the outcomes of a practitioner or hospital in a wealthy suburb somewhere. The social support systems are entirely different. The outcomes have been demonstrated to be different. To be held to the same standard is simply not fair.
Well, and I'm just saying that, our general guidance is not to just throw those things into a risk adjustment, but that, certainly, it's open to discussion and rationale.
Well, I do realize it's controversial, and I mentioned that in my presentation.
Right. Right.
But I think that the controversy revolves about the fact that we shouldn't be sanctioning poor care for these patients, and I agree to that. But again, I would come back to any of a number of examples, but let's use age as one. Just because age is in the risk adjustment model doesn't mean we're discriminating against the elderly.
Well, age has a lot of physiological
components related to it. But
I just want to add one point to what Karen was saying, just in terms of our evaluation criteria. What it actually says is don't whisk away things that are potentially really important things for us to see. And so the recommendation is that you stratify.
Right.
Okay.
The issues like that should be stratified.
So stratification, from my standpoint, would be fine.
Okay. I just want to clarify that. The second thing is just to respond to something else you said, Ariel. You're representing yourself. You're here as a technical expert. You're not speaking to the organization for whom you are nominated. You were nominated by somebody else, but you're here as your own technical expert.
Well, that's really the way I'm speaking.
I assume as much, but I want to clarify for the sake of the table.
Good work.
Other comments? Dr. Ortiz?
Yes, so I'm definitely, I'm not an interventional cardiologist, I'm an electrophysiologist, but I can't help but raise the question as to whether the 15-day time frame is actually the, you know, ideal time frame for this measure.
As opposed to the
30-day, you know, because I'm concerned that we may end up, you know, missing some of the, important readmissions that we would like to capture. Having said that, I know that there are many readmissions that are not related to the procedure, and I'm not sure how valid the codes are to try to decide, you know, what is, you know, related to the procedure, what's not. But I would also point out that some of the discharge codes may not be, like, readily obvious to be related to the procedure. For example, when we do an AP study or when we do an ablation procedure, I can always, you know, tap into our own experience. Sometimes patients come back with pneumonia, but it's like aspiration pneumonia from the type of anesthesia that they received or what have you. The types of reasons for admissions may not be totally separate or independent of the procedures that they actually had. I'm not sure how easily it would be to determine that, but I think that's something to keep in mind.
Mm-hmm.
So if I could comment on the pneumonia issue. I agree with your comment that it's not always that easy to determine linkage, but our anesthesia is not nearly as deep as yours, and our patients very, very rarely aspirate.
Dr. Rich?
2 points. First, I'd like to elaborate on the points that Dr. Ellis made regarding the risk adjustment for social support and so forth, which I completely agree with. But I think it really goes beyond the social support issue in resource availability and ability to pay for and get the medications that are prescribed, and I think that Plavix in particular is a major concern due to its cost and availability of this to indigent patients and so forth, and that invariably contributes significantly to early readmissions after discharge of persons who take the Plavix, and I think that absolutely needs to be adjusted in the model, otherwise institutions that are serving indigent populations are, in my opinion, unfairly penalized. As Dr. Ellis said, I completely agree with. The second point that I wanted to make is that I'm less concerned about admissions for unrelated issues such as the chronic bronchitis and the COPD exacerbations and pneumonias and so forth, because of the fact that it constitutes a relatively small percentage. And you could look at this, but it seems that that's likely to be similar from one hospital to another, the proportion that come in for those indications. And if procedure-related readmissions constitute the bulk of the readmissions, then it still would work out fair to look at the overall readmission rate and say, well, this hospital has an 8% readmission rate, this hospital has a 5%. You can look at it and say, well, was this 8% due to a higher number of pneumonia admissions? And even if it was, I think that there's something suggesting that something was happening in that institution that contributed to a high rate of pneumonia. It might not be related to the procedure, but it still reflects the overall quality of the care provided. As Dr. Gibbons pointed out, I think this becomes really more of an issue in heart failure, where a much larger proportion of early readmissions are apparently completely unrelated to heart failure and really reflect the fact that that the heart failure population has many more comorbidities and are much more likely to be readmitted for other medical problems rather than for heart failure. But for PCI, I have less concern about that.
That may well be true. It would be nice, and I don't have access to data, maybe somebody around the table does, it would be nice to have access to see the hospital-to-hospital variation on the things that we could all pretty much agree on have nothing to do with the procedure. I would be a little concerned that the patient's comorbidities might really drive those, and if there are major differences in comorbidities that are not measured, then you might see some disparities that are not, you know, that the analysis would not essentially be fair to the provider.
Dr. Brinker?
The only thing I would add is I think we have to say that readmissions are a quagmire, pure and simple, whether it's 15 days or 30 days. Surgeons have certainly been marked at 30 days, and we were taught 30 days is 30 days, but who knows why it's 30 days that makes the difference, or then it's 1 month. So I think with that almost as the platform, the question I would ask, and it may be because I'm not familiar enough with the candidate measure, is this is to measure readmissions just to the original hospital, or gets captured at a hospital 60 miles away where the patient was readmitted, where the emergency room looked and saw a little pleural effusion and said, oh, got to readmit him. And if Dr. Ellis had walked down to the emergency room, I think there's one in Cleveland, right? It's small, though. If they had walked down the emergency room and said, this patient's fine. That's why readmissions are quite much. So I think one of our responsibilities is to say, what are we really looking to do? Are we looking to create a system that we have less readmissions and everybody understands how to have less readmissions? And does that do it by 15 days or 30 days, or does that do it by changing the risk model and adding socioeconomic issues, which I think are a major aspect of this? So that's one of my problems with this whole concept, really. I mean, the ER, without even calling the interventionalist, may admit 5 patients in a row who didn't have to be readmitted, really.
So I think that's a good point, and I think it's an issue sort of ownership, and the emergency room gets no ownership on this measure, nor penalty if they perform poorly,
right.
Unless it's part of the system for the providing hospital, which, as you point out, is actually I don't have data, but it's often not the case.
But usually there's not any correction for attribution, and attribution is what people find most unsettling, that someone else is dealing with your issue that you might have managed a little bit differently. But that's true for almost any of the measures with readmission. That's part of the problem. And even some of the major players don't correct for attribution.
Just a comment. This is a hospital-level measure, so wouldn't it seem that it would be appropriate for the proceduralist, whatever your procedure is, and it sounds like there needs to be better either communication relations processes between your ERs and, you know, patients who might come back to them in terms of evaluating them.
Right.
Isn't that a potential avenue for addressing these kinds of things? Because it's not a measure of the individual doc, it's a measure of the hospital.
Right. So I think that's spot on for admissions coming through your own emergency room. And I wish I had data to tell you how many of the admits were to somebody else's emergency room. I would guess it's at least 30%, if not greater. And the problem is you have no control over those emergency rooms outside your own hospital system. Now, obviously, we have more systems available to us now than we did a decade ago. But I think that's part of the problem, that you have no control over some of the emergency rooms who might be admitting your patient.
For heart failure, it's about 10% in the state of Washington go to another place. But for procedure and for large referral institutions, I suspect that you're right. It's a much larger number.
What percentage of the PCIs are non-MI PCIs?
40 to 50.
Because if you look at the way the measures are going with the MI or the heart failure, with that evaluation and management system, if you change it to the 15 days, it puts more pressure on that group to get that evaluation and management visit system, whatever, put in place and that patient seen within that 15 days to make the impact on your readmission. That's the only a negative about pushing that time period.
This is a slightly tangential comment, but it's prompted by your comment. One might argue that we should have an ACS, we should capture ACS patients rather than PCI patients because it more globally reflects patient care for the same problem.
Other comments? Can we get perspective from the developing organization?
Yes, sir. Thanks for the opportunity. You guys have hit on really every key element of this measure in rapid fashion, so I commend you on your ability to drill down quickly. I think that there are legitimate arguments on either side and of all the issues that have been raised, and I would say that over the past year that we've developed the measure, we really have attempted to work our way through that with expert guidance. in order to get to some consensus that at the end of the day leads to a measure that we hope will be used to improve the care of this particular patient population. Just to reemphasize from our perspective, this is not a measure of interventional cardiologists. This is a measure of a group of patients who are undergoing a procedure that unites them. That's how we're identifying them, but one that reflects the processes of care not only in the index hospitalization, but throughout that time period following it. And so it's really a measure of the structure of care and the way in which it's delivered. Some would like to just try and address, and my notes are getting a little messy here, but some of the specific comments. I think that the biggest tension for this measure, and it's been consistent in all the expert panels, working groups, and public comments, has been twofold. First, it's the issue of all-cause readmission versus cause-specific readmission, and secondly, has to do with the risk adjustment methodology and how do you, whether or not it is appropriate to include socioeconomic status or other patient-level factors that may influence the outcomes of interest. To address specifically the all-cause, you know, there's this tension that then you've heard arguments on both sides of it today as to broadening the scope of the measure that you're developing versus trying to apply the most narrow focus possible. And so on the one hand, all-cause readmission is a broad focus, a broader scope, or you could alternatively narrow it down to specific administrative codes or readmissions for specific purposes to try and remove some of the noise. And that's really, I think, what it boils down to is how much noise are you willing to accept in order to obtain the broadest signal possible. I think that's sort of what we've come to. Our process, and one that's consistent with the other measures that we've developed for MI, pneumonia, heart failure, has really been always along the lines that we would rather err on having the broadest scope possible and accept some degree of non-attributability of some of these readmissions. So we know that you can never get this readmission rate down to zero. There are always going to be that readmissions that will happen no matter how good the quality of care. Some of that may be driven by just the degree of illness of the patient, and maybe by their resources. But we assume that embedded within that measure, there is a signal and a substantial signal of quality of care delivered at the hospital and beyond. The time frame is the other, contentious issue that we faced, and that's really been, we examined that, and I think if you look at the figure in the document as to the timing of readmissions from 0 to 90 days and what the instantaneous rates are in the overall Medicare population, you can see that the rates do decrease over time. We felt, going back and forth, that there were some good reasons to use 30 days. First off, just looking at the figure, examining it, it looks like it's really starting to plateau somewhere between 30 and 45 days, so that there is sort of a, number one, there's a baseline risk that Medicare patients undergoing PCI, or any Medicare patient, regardless of the condition, there's a basal rate of readmissions, and it's somewhere around, actually 17%, I think, for all acute care conditions, 17% of those patients are readmitted at 30 days. So we know that that's going to be the case, but it seems like within that first 30 days there is an acceleration or an increase of that risk that slowly abates and again sort of comes down to a baseline level between 30 and 45 days. So that was probably the biggest or largest reason why we proposed that. It also is consistent with the other measures that we've developed, and I think there is some value, maybe small, in being consistent so that we share the focus as we cross-cut across conditions. And I think that really also it has to do with the scope of the measure. I think it really makes it a little bit broader. It forces hospitals and systems to think a little bit outside of what they're used to. You know, it's very easy, and I know clinically we're focused on what's going on in the hospital, and we're not always as focused on the transition of care. 15 days certainly is an option, and you can argue one way or another for it, but I think this pushes the envelope for where we make our investment a little bit further out, which I think may have advantages in terms of improving the quality of the care delivered to these patients. But the arguments can cut both ways. A couple other just specific issues. I think Karen had clarified that for the reporting of patients, this is not a voluntary measure. That's not the intent of it. It should not be penalizing hospitals or making hospitals that participate in CAPS-PCI won't be penalized. In fact, you know, we think that there may be advantages to their longer-term participation in CAPS-PCI in terms of familiarity with the data and so less burden to them that this measure would impose. But the goal, as I understand it, and I think it's fair to say, is that it would be applied equally to all hospitals that perform PCI. Okay.
So where does the data come for the non-ACC and CDR?
So that's an implementation issue, and I don't want to go too far
But I think unless you've demonstrated the validity of the risk-adjusted model using other data sources, then it's a major gap in our understanding of how well the model is going to perform. So I mean, there's always this issue of using administrative data sets, which I gather you're going to have to use if they don't report to the ACC and CDR. And those data sets those models typically are not as accurate. But correct me, maybe I'm making some presumptions.
Right.
Where is the data supposed to come from for the non-ACC and CDR reporting hospitals?
My name is Leanne Hahn, and I'm from CMS. This is a implementation issue. Let me explain this way. Well, CMS asked Yale to develop outcome measures and using the preferably using the clinical data. So with this contract, and they look for data to develop this risk adjustment model, and they find data in registry. If CMS were to implement this measure, we will implement under the authority of the pay-for public reporting program. That's what we call RECTAPOO program, hospital quality, reporting hospital quality for annual updates, the payment. So under that authority, the CMS will require all hospitals submit the data to CMS. So registry definitely is one of the mechanisms that a hospital can use, or the a process hospital can use to submit data to CMS. But what will be the CMS required hospital under the authority of RECTAPOO, and CMS will calculate. So I think I just try to address the issue about voluntary.
So I'm still not quite sure I understand. So every parameter in the risk adjustment model that we have heard about,
yes,
will be reported by the hospital to CMS?
CMS were to implement this measure, that will be the model. Like currently we have four process of care measures, and mortality readmission, we use the claims base, so we have the claims. So, but if we were to implement, then that would be the case.
So it can either be reported via the registry, the ACC registry, or by hospital directly reporting to you, is that right?
Well, we don't have a definite plan yet, but definitely is the relation between hospital and CMS. CMS will come up with a process to collect the data, but it's between hospital and CMS. So registry is currently have the infrastructure to collect the data. Definitely is a very good start on the. Like I said, well, we don't have a definite plan how to do this yet.
But
Leanne, the way you described it in the prior project is that hospitals would not be required to join the registry, that CMS would develop some alternative mechanism, whether it's directly to CMS or to another contractor that you
yes.
would...
That's why I'm trying to say it's between hospital and CMS, and we cannot require hospital to pay a fee especially to one place, So that will be, I would just say that look at the current CMS model for the process of care measures. CMS doesn't have a contractor,
provide alternative for hospitals to submit data.
And what's the audit mechanism for that to prevent gaming?
I'm sorry?
What is the audit mechanism for that to prevent gaming?
Prevent gaming. I think you're talking about like data validation.
So
well,
on-site validation?
Yeah. Well, currently, CMS, for the process measure, we do have a validation there. So that's the current model. So, and I also understand, I mean, I shouldn't go there, but I know the ACC has a process to validate the data. That would be a...
That audit mechanism is particularly weak. Very
yeah.
weak.
Okay. Validation certainly is an issue for us to take into account when we implement the measure.
How will you know if the data reported directly to CMS is equivalent to the data that's reported through the registry?
If I understand correctly, you would say equivalent. I think we will, based on the specs that currently we have for this measure, that will be the basic data abstraction rule, or I would say that the hospital has to follow.
And so the same question really for Dr. Ellis is, since the registry is voluntary reporting, is there some sort of system to validate the data that's reported?
So I wrote that, and maybe I should have listed that as a major deficiency. So I will say that, as I mentioned, I was involved with version 1.1 of this, and I pushed for auditing for a long time. There is it a 5% audit now? It's 5% audit. And I actually, I'm not sure if those results have been made public. Maybe somebody
at
the table tell us. And I think that there is a concern about the susceptibility of this to gaming, quite honestly.
In which case it seems that it would be better to have everything reported directly through CMS and they can deal with the issue of validating data and not use the registry at all.
That would be one
option. A bit of an issue, aren't
yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that would be one. I think what you're saying, a major deficiency of the data quality, I think that's an implementation issue that CMS needs to take into account, but while we implement the measure.
I guess I find it a little hard to divorce implementation, since that's a practical consequence of what we're talking about, and say, well, we'll just leave implementation aside. Let's critique the measure on other parameters.
But I think it's that we have to take that into account when we implement it here. So.
Well, I would say I think we're trying to assess whether or not, you know, this measure as proposed meets the criteria outlined by NQF in terms of importance, feasibility, scientific capability, et cetera, and make the assumption that it will adhere to these similar standards or these same standards when and if it is implemented. I think that's a safe assumption, right?
Yeah.
So just regarding the data audit program, it is 5% of hospitals that participate in the CAPCCI are currently audited. My understanding is that the audit focuses right now on the variables that go into the mortality model, the inpatient mortality model for it. I don't believe it's public, but I think in the report we referred to, at least for the majority of the variables that are actually in the mortality measure or the mortality model, that the data quality is at least in excess of 88% accurate, or 88%. I believe that's what
I'm not. Don't take me as a naysayer, because mm-hmm. I actually believe that we should be assessing quality, but I have some particular problems with this measure, and I don't think 88% accuracy is very good. I've run our own PCI database for years, and so we shoot for 99% plus.
Right. So there's variation across the sites, and I'd say that to me it's obvious that no matter what happens, that ensuring the data quality needs to be put into place, and those mechanisms need to be firmly in place. There is the example of how it has been implemented in the Massachusetts experience, which there are strong opinions about that experience overall. But you can say that they have, I think, done a remarkable job of trying to ensure the quality of the data to make sure that the inferences that we're making about hospital quality are, to the extent possible, fair and valid.
I just have one, maybe two points to add. I heard about variation issues here, but I think from CMS perspective, readmission rate is high here. and that's what we try to focus on. Readmission rate is high. And I would like to reiterate that this point again, that the CMS goal is not to reduce readmission rate to zero. No measure is perfect. But our goal is to shift the total distribution of the readmission of the hospital in the nation, shift that curve, is not to just focus on, you know, reduce or penalize, you know, a very small proportion of the hospital. So that's our goal. And the other thing is, from the policy perspective, I want to address the SES issue. It's not right, or it's difficult for CMS to say that we hold hospitals that have a high proportion of poor patients from a lower SES of different standards, or different race, have disproportionately different race of population, different standards. So that's our point here. You know, how do we not to just focus on that? I mean, we just cannot hold different hospitals, that hospitals have different population, different standards.
Let me just follow up on that point. Is that actually, if you look at hospitals that take care of a high proportion of patients who have low socioeconomic status or education status or whatever, you do see that there are the portion of those hospitals that are able to achieve excellent outcomes.
Yes.
And so the distribution of risk standardized mortality rates and readmission rates for heart failure among critical access hospitals who take care of an incredibly high burden of low socioeconomic status patients, the distribution of the risk standardized outcome rates are virtually overlapping with those of non-critical access hospitals.
I guess our own data would suggest for PCI that's not the case. It is the case for AMI and heart failure, the safety net hospitals. I've looked at this recently. The safety net hospitals in, across the United States actually do overlap with the food preservative.
Well,
I'm sure they overlap, but I think, it, you know, at least in our own data, and I think there's several sources that we could cite, suggest that that's an important covariate that is highly statistically correlated with outcomes.
Right. But I think you're talking at the patient level, at the individual level of the individual
that,
patient,
that
as opposed to the,
point,
the overall population of patients
cared for
at the hospital.
I
think that's a significant difference in terms of how you approach it.
Perhaps with that as background, we could go through, and many of these issues I think will come up in terms of our assessment.
Right.
In terms of validity, feasibility, and usability. So
Thank you for the comments. I thought that providing the overview would allow us to
finish
this document pretty quickly.
Thought on it.
Okay, very fine. So you're looking then for my critique and recommendations for each of these as we go along? Is that correct?
For the sub-criteria, yeah.
For the sub-criteria.
It's important to measure and report.
2A, 2A, and we're skipping 2A. 1.
No, only 1. You do 1A and 1. DC. Mm-hmm.
All right, so these are considerations for AQF staff. So, I guess we should just go through these. So, the measures in the public domain, I thought this is fine.
Yeah, you can go down to the importance to measure and report.
Okay, fine. So, I agreed with the NQF staff appraisal on items, all items under number one.
You provided the...
NQF staff only looked at the conditions, which were...
Sorry, I'm having a little bit of problem with your nomenclature here, but
okay,
sorry. You are quite correct.
Right.
All right.
Okay.
So let's go to importance to measure and report. So it is, we agree, it's a common procedure. There are lots of readmissions. Readmissions are undesirable in many cases. So I think that's really needs a rating of C or complete.
Anyone disagree?
I don't know whether I should pause for each of these or just run through the ratings. So what do people want to do?
If there's any substantial question or disagreement, I think we can just go on if there is none.
Right. Under opportunity for improvement, there has been, as noted, substantial hospital-to-hospital variation noted. One would infer then that there is an opportunity for improvement. So I would mark this as a C for complete also.
Any comments? Everyone agree?
So under
1C.
1C. Evidence or outcomes to support measure focus. The focus is fine. I think there's some concerns about, you know, how we measure it, how we define it, and how we risk adjust, but the focus is fine. That's a key also. And then when you come down to the bottom of number one, was the threshold criteria important to measure important met? And my answer is I believe it has been.
Are there any particular weaknesses in relationship to these sub-criteria that you need to highlight? I heard strengths, but I'm hearing weaknesses.
Well, I think I tried to cover them all in my overview.
All right. But in terms of the importance criteria, I didn't hear anything.
Okay.
So essentially, it's the consensus of the committee that see across the board for the three sub-criteria, which you all agree on.
Mm-hmm. All right. Under number 2A, the measure precisely specified, and I believe it has been. That's a C, the recommendation for C.
Okay. Any comments? Okay. Moving right along.
Under 2B, reliability testing. And here I have some concerns. The way I interpret this portion of the evaluation, it encompasses whether or not the measure reliably identifies outliers in different but similar patient cohorts, i.e. 2007 compared to 2006. Did you have the 2007 data to share with us?
So actually, the measure was developed in 2007 data, and it was validated in 2006 data.
I'm sorry, so I misunderstood that. But I've not seen. So what's the Cohen's kappa then for identification of outlying hospitals?
So in this application, we don't actually define how we're going to characterize outliers. That's not missing.
So I would say that the P partial.
And just to clarify, what our evaluation criteria are about reliability is really the repeatability, reproducibility of the measure score, or sometimes that people look at the reliability of the underlying data items as something that they address here.
All right, so if we're looking at the reliability of the underlying data elements, we talked about, or we've alluded to gaming and the fact that they're not audits, there's no audits here. So I still stand that this is I don't believe this has been completely met.
Right.
I would say minimally met. I'm not sure that it's what partially met.
All right, well, maybe we should have some discussion around that.
So you mentioned in your submission the 2007 audit results are not yet available, but did you have other, like, 2006 data?
So, you know, and I don't have it here. In the PCR mortality report that we went through last year, we provided the 2006 data audit report, and it's not 88%. It's substantially higher. 88% was the lower bound for any single variable in terms of the data accuracy, okay? I would argue that certainly the data is, you know, I would argue accurate in the sense that the numbers that are put are valid, that the NCDR has a very strong process for filtering the data, cleaning the data, and making sure that all the information that is submitted is at least within a valid range, and then it's subsequently augmented by this data process. I mean, I don't think that at this point there's no reason to suspect that the data is not valid.
I would respectfully disagree, being a submitting site to this registry. I think that several points would speak to that. First of all, there's been a trend upward in a lot of the comorbidities used in the mortality model that are largely inexplicable by changes in patient population. That is to say, there's a problem with upcoding, or maybe. And the lack of transparency in the audit process I found troubling.
Okay.
I would go for partial.
Let me just.
I mean, based on the data, the additional data that you provided,
mm-hmm.
Jeff, I think I would go for partially. I don't know that it was complete. I don't know what the
other. Can I just make one other point? And maybe it's not valid for this exercise, but what is the alternative source of data? If you say that by that rationale, any measure that you develop that's based on administrative data is completely invalid, right?
Well, it's suspect.
So
I think the scientific community would say
it's
suspect.
We have that as the bar.
Yeah.
So where do you want to land in terms of an evaluation, the entire group? You're saying partial, Dr. Ellis?
I'm recommending partial.
Anyone else want to weigh in here? Disagree? Agree? Okay. It is.
All right, well, we're on to 2C, and here I need to admit the fact I'm not a statistician, and I don't fully understand the distinction between reliable and valid, or validity. So maybe somebody can explain